Welcome back. Previously, we first introduced cosmological models, cosmological solutions to the Einstein equations, in particular the Friedmann-Lemaître solutions that are dominating the study of cosmology today. And then we studied the classification of symmetries of the space-time by studying the symmetries of the Ricci curvature and the symmetries of the Weyl curvature. An open question was left, which is, can we be sure that solutions that were found on the basis of stringent symmetry assumptions and that featured singularities such as certain cosmological solutions or such as the black hole solutions of Schwarzschild and others, whether they are real? In the sense that in real life, there are no actual exact symmetries. There can only be approximate symmetries. And then the question arises whether these approximate symmetries are enough to guarantee that singularities actually form, for example, at the centers of black holes or at the beginning of an expanding universe. This is a very important topic and very difficult because if we do not make symmetry assumptions, we cannot solve the Einstein equations. And yet, we want to know whether the Einstein equations do or do not necessarily lead to singularities. So we'll have to do a careful study of how we can identify singularities, and then under which conditions we can derive that there have to be singularities, even in the absence of exact solutions. We can, as we will see today and in the next lecture, can actually derive conditions, plausible conditions, under which necessarily, no matter the details, necessarily singularities must form. So to this end, let's start with a careful study of the causal structure of space-times and what we mean by singularities. So first we need to study the causal structure of space-times. And we start with the definition of what is a time-orientable space-time. We say that the space-time, defined by giving a differentiable manifold and a metric on it, is what is called time-orientable if at each point of the manifold we can separate the non-space-like vectors, so the light and time-like vectors, into two classes, which will be called future-directed and past-directed. In other words, we say that a space-time is time-orientable if, in a continuous way, we can tell what is the future, what is the past at every point. So we don't want that the definition of future and past jumps as we go from one point to a neighboring point. Indeed, the Einstein equations permit all sorts of super weird solutions. In principle, solutions in which we would have a space-time in which we cannot even tell future from the past. In a sense that's illustrated here by that example. Imagine a space-time that is given here like the surface of a can. And imagine that as we go around that can, along the equator of the can, so to speak, we have drawn here light cones, and let's say here, this light cone here has that the upper light cone is, let's say, towards the future, and the lower one is towards the past. And you see that as we go to the right, it tilts and then further tilts. And as we go around the can, we might come back with a 180-degree tilt. So, in a continuous fashion, the light cones tilted, and now you see, we come from here, and that's actually the past light cone, and that's the future light cone. So, the whole thing is continuous, but you see, we do not have, therefore, a continuously labeled, consistent definition of what the future is. Because if we say the upper is the future, 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 well, then we have the future is down there. And we would have to, in order to make the whole thing a continuous definition of what the future is, well, we can't do it, because this light cone and that light cone, between those two, we would have to flip it from past to future. So in principle, general relativity allows that sort of thing. We do not think that the universe is like that, but the Einstein equations permit that sort of thing. Now, if a space-time is time-orientable, then there exist, I mean, by if, I put a double F here, which means if and only if the space-time is time-orientable, then there exists a smooth, non-vanishing, time-like vector field V on that manifold. You see, if you have such a smooth, meaning continuous and differentiable, non-vanishing, time-like vector field, non-vanishing meaning, keep that in mind, I explain in a second why that's important, smooth time-like vector field, if we have that, then we can define the future and the past relative to it. So if we have one of these smooth, non-vanishing, time-like vector fields, then we can define for any other time-like vector field that it is pointing to the future if its inner product with this reference vector field is, let's say, larger than zero. And we can say that a time-like vector points into the past if its inner product with that reference vector V is negative. Or we could also define it the other way around, of course. That's a convention. And why is that? Well, remember that at any point in the manifold, we can choose a Riemann normal coordinate system. Or we can just freely choose a basis in a tangent space anyway. And we can choose the basis always in such a way that the metric tensor actually takes the form of eta mu nu. Which means that this reference vector field everywhere in this basis, as a tangent vector, everywhere takes the form of some number V naught and then 0, 0, 0. You can always do that. And this V naught is now a non-vanishing function, because it's a non-vanishing vector field, right? A non-vanishing time-like vector field. And since it's not vanishing ever, the V naught never changes sign. And therefore, defining whether an arbitrary tangent vector is time-like, is pointing into the future, or pointing into the past, by defining it through the inner product, is to say, well, is minus V naught psi naught positive or negative? You see? And that's now a global definition, because the V naught, as a reference vector field, never vanishes, never changes its sign. Later we will see that such a time-like, never-vanishing vector field could be a gradient field. And we will see in what condition, under what condition that happens. It's a convenient extra. So in the future now, we will consider only time-like, time-orientable space-times. So we will only consider space-times where in a continuous fashion we can assign for every event on the space-time what is the future light cone and which is the past light cone. So we will always assume not only that it's orientable, but also that the time orientation has been chosen. Now, on such a time-oriented space-time, let's consider time-like curves. A curve, or also called a path, is, of course, as you remember, simply a mapping from a subset or all of the real line into the manifold. So some parameter is parametrizing a trajectory in the manifold. And such a curve is called a future-directed time-like curve if every tangent vector to this curve, obtained by taking gamma dot, so differentiating the coordinates with respect to the parameter of our curve, if every tangent vector is a future-directed time-like vector. Remember, these are two conditions to check. Time-like means that its length squared is negative, because we have this signature in the metric where it's minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So time-like is something that we've always worked with, but future-directed means that the inner product of the gamma dot with the reference vector v that defines what is future-directed is always, let's say, positive for the forward, for the future light cone. And just a little subtlety here, future-directed time-like curve, that doesn't include the case where the curve is such that for all parameter values, we just stick at the same point. Technically, that's also a curve, but it's not a future-directed time-like curve, right? Because a time-like curve must have that the length squared of the tangent vector is negative. Zero is not allowed. But if gamma dot was equal to zero, then it's not time-like, technically speaking. It would qualify as light-like, but it's not time-like. Okay, so a future-directed time-like curve is any curve that we personally could travel, given the right equipment of rockets and all that. Now, we also define curves that are not called time-like, but that are called causal curves, future-directed causal curves. So again, we have a path, a curve, gamma parameterized by a set of real numbers. It's a trajectory in the manifold, and it is called future-directed causal curve if, on one hand, it's future-directed. Remember, that's the sign that the tangent vectors have, in the inner product with the reference vector v, so future-directed. And causal means that it is either time-like or null. Time-like or light-like. Causal means it could have a causal influence. It's not necessarily travelable by matter, but at least by light it should be travelable. So let's keep that in mind. Time-like means the length squared of the tangent vector is negative. Causal means the length squared of the tangent vector is negative or zero, because we do allow light-like. And then, as we mentioned over here, gamma dot equal to zero, the path that just stays at one point, is technically one of those. And similarly, we can define path-directed time-like curves and path-directed causal curves. The only difference is that the sign changes of the inner product with respect to the reference vector that singles out the past and the future. So now we can define the past and the future of an event. We define the future of an event. So if P is some event of the manifold, we define the future, or more specifically, the so-called chronological future, to be a set which we call capital I plus of P. The chronological future of an event is the set of all events that can be reached from P on a future-directed time-like curve. So if P is an event, then capital I plus of that event is the set of all events that a traveler could travel to from P with any speed, but not quite the speed of light. By the way, that set is always an open set, because you could always go a little faster. You will not reach the speed of light, but you know, it's always an open set. Now, technically, we have that the event itself is not in its chronological future, because the gamma dot equal to zero, which would be that path that we would require in that case, is, of course, not chronological. It's causal, but it's not chronological. It's not time-like. Now, similar to how we distinguished future-directed time-like curves from future-directed causal curves by this subtle difference whether or not we allow the speed of light, where time-like curves are curves that can be traveled by matter, and causal curves are curves that can be traveled by matter and by light, or by light. The chronological future is defined as the set of all events that can be reached by time-like travel from P. And the causal future, that is denoted by J plus of P, is the set of all events that can be reached either by matter or by light. So we now allow also the speed of light. And clearly we always have that the event itself is also part of its causal future because, you know, the event itself is reached by the path, which just stays at one point, so that gamma dot is equal to zero, but that qualifies technically as being a causal curve because the length squared is zero. And similarly, we can of course define the chronological past, which will be identified, which will be written as capital I minus of an event, and the causal past, which is written as capital J minus of an event. So again, the chronological past is a set of all events from which you can travel to P with matter, and the causal past of an event P is the set of all those events from which you can travel to P if you are either matter or light. These definitions applied to one event. What's the future of an event? What's the past event? What's the chronological future of an event? What's the causal future of the event and the past? We can generalize that to the past and the futures of a set of events. And that leads us, for example, to a convenient, succinct definition of what is an event horizon. So let's say S is a set of events. For example, it could be the set of events that the person experiences. It could be your world line. But it could also be a space-like hypersurface. It could be anything. It's just some set of events. So we define now the pasts and the futures of a set of events. So for example, the chronological future, so I plus of S, S being the set of events whose future we are interested in, this is simply the union of all the chronological futures of the individual events. So P is an element of S, it has a chronological future, capital I plus, and we just take the union of those. And similarly, we have the causal future of a bunch of events, and that's just the causal future of each event, and then we just take the union of all these events. It will be important to consider also the boundaries of these futures, of the chronological future and the boundary of the causal future of an event or of a set of events. And we will denote those with a dot. So capital I plus dot, for example, is the boundary, in the sense of a manifold, is the boundary of the chronological future of a set of events S. Or for example, J dot minus is the boundary of the chronological, of the causal past of a set of events. So for example, let's say S, the set S of events, is the set of events traveled by an immortal observer, somebody who keeps traveling forever. So S is the world line of some observer, then who goes on forever. Then we can ask, well, what's the causal past of that observer? Or technically, what's the causal past of that set of events? Well, technically, that's the set of everything that our observer will ever learn about, or can ever learn about, right? Because it's the causal past of that observer. It's the set of all those events from which, using snail mail, or using Wi-Fi, you could use matter, or you could use light, you could send a message to the observer, right? So J minus is the set of all those events from which you could have sent a message to our traveler who travels the world line S. So J minus of S is the set of all events from which messages could be sent one way or the other, with or without matter, below or at the speed of light, to S, to our observer. And now, what is J minus dot? That's the boundary of the set of events that can communicate to our observer. This is as far as our observer can see, literally, right? If all those events in J minus of S actually had a light bulb attached to them, then literally, this is what the J minus of S is literally what S would see. It sees all the messages from all the events, right? So if every event created the flash of light in the direction of our observer S, or actually anywhere, then J minus of S is everything that S can ever see. And so the dot of that is the horizon of that, is, you know, it's beyond that, if there is a beyond, beyond that the observer cannot see. And that's what is the definition of the event horizon. It's a very good choice, the word horizon. It's just like you're traveling on the ocean and you see sail ships. Some sail ships are just beyond the horizon. They're still there, but you can't see them. The light cannot reach you there. Okay, so an event horizon is always relative to a choice of a set of events. And typically, the set of events has to be a world line. And it's just the boundary of this observer's causal past. Now, when we talked about paths here, or trajectories, or curves, then they didn't need to be geodesics, just any paths. Now, let's look at geodesics in particular. In Minkowski space, it's clear that I plus of P, so the future, the chronological future, or also called in this case simply the time-like future, of an event, is the set, can also be described as the set of events which are reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics from P. Meaning that it's a set of all those events that you can reach by throwing a stone or any other matter. You know, you don't have to take any evasive measures. You can do it with a geodesic. And the boundary of the chronological future, so I plus of P dot, what is that? Well, the boundary is the light cone, right? It's the boundary of the light cone, because I plus of P is just the inside of the future light cone, and then that is the boundary of the future light cone. And that's, of course, spanned, that boundary is spanned by the events reachable by future-directed null geodesics from P. That's the light, literally the light cone. But it turns out that it's not that easy in general. And we can use that difference. We can use the fact that this is true for Minkowski space, but not generally for generic spacetimes. We can use that to identify geodesics even when we do not have the exact solutions. Even when we don't exactly know what the spacetime is or what the geodesics are and so on. And why is it that that's not so easy here? Why is that not so straightforward? You see, we made use of the following fact here, which is that a light beam sent from the event P can trace out all of the boundary of the light cone. We assume here that there is no singularity on the light cone, that there's no hole in the manifold. So whenever that fails, we have an indication that there might be a singularity. But it's actually more subtle than that, as we will see.
As a quick question, if I dot and J dot are the boundaries of the respective spaces. What would they ever be different or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we will see that.
Okay.
Exactly. That's the point, that they will be different.
No.
Yes. Okay. So locally, though, locally, we usually have that the situation is similar to Minkowski space. Namely, let's assume that P is a point in the manifold, and let's assume that U is a neighborhood around P, which is convex normal. Convex normal means that in that neighborhood, any two points are connected by one geodesic and only one geodesic. So there's no lensing effect. That could mess things a bit up. You know, lensing where, you know, you send a geodesic this way and that way, but those geodesics meet again. So a geodesically convex neighborhood doesn't have that happen. So assume we have, we pick a point in the manifold and some small enough neighborhood so that it is convex normal, and that means that there are unique geodesics between any two events. Then we have that the chronological future of an event P is the set of events that is reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics, just like in Minkowski space. And we have that the boundary is the set of events reachable by future-directed null geodesics from P, as we just discussed, is no problem in Minkowski space. And then, if a point Q is in the causal future, but it is not in the chronological or time-like future of P, well then there has to be, then the causal curves between Q and P have to be light-like between them. Now, let me just remind you, because we will need these definitions over and over again, so just to make sure you remember them. The chronological future of a set S, here we were still talking about events, but now, again, the set S is a set of events. The chronological future of a set S, denoted capital I plus of S, is the set of events that can be reached from S on future-directed time-like curves, and the causal future of a set S, written J plus, is the set of events that can be reached from events S, either with or without matter, with matter or with light. And what we have is that in Minkowski space, we have that the causal future of a set of events is given by the chronological future of that set of events union with the boundary of the causal future of this set of events. And similar statements, of course, hold true for the past. We just have to replace the pluses with minuses here. And there's also no overlap between this set and that set. That's why we can write a dot over there. But in general, things can be a bit more non-trivial. So let us look at the properties of the boundary of the chronological future of a set of events in general. So not just in a small neighborhood or a Minkowski space. First, we will define we will call a subset Q of the manifold A chrono if no two points in that set can be connected by a future-directed time-like curve. That is to say, Q is called A chrono if you cannot travel as a person with matter from one event to the other event. Light could do it. Or they could also be space-like separated, these events, the achronal events, but they are not allowed to be time-like to another. Another way to say that is that Q is a achronal subset of M. This middle bar should not be there. Q is an achronal subset of M if the chronological future of Q intersecting with Q itself is the empty set. That's just to say that you can't travel with matter between any two points of your subset Q. And then there's the theorem, which says that if S is some subset of M, so for example, indicated like this, roughly, this is just a sketch of it, but upwards could be time, and to the right could be space, for example. So if S is, and therefore 45 degrees is like a light cone, so if S is some set in the manifold, and I plus is the chronological future of this set of events, then I plus dot of S is the boundary of that. If S was just one event, then this would be a point only, and these two lines are just actually the light cone. So the claim is that the boundary of the chronological future of S is always achronal. It's three-dimensional, and it's an achronal submanifold. And one special case we are familiar with, namely the special case where S is just a point. This is the light cone, so this is the future light cone. And the future light cone has all events light-like related to each other, so they're achronal, right? Because achronal means you cannot connect any two events. A set is achronal if you cannot connect any two events with a light, with a time-like curve. And of course, the light cone is light-like. All the events in the light cone are, it's a light-like curve. So there's no, it's achronal. That's this this example. Now, in general spacetimes, however, and this gets to your question, in general spacetimes, what we have is this. If we take the chronological future of a set of events, and then we consider the closure of it, so we add to it the its boundary, so that's I plus of S union with the I plus dot of S. So if we look at the closure of that, it's the same as the closure of the causal future of S. But, and this is a fundamental issue that we can use to detect singularities, we notice that on a generic spacetime, the closure of the chronological future of S, that's why there's the bar, because the closure, doesn't have to be the same as just the causal future of S. Now, why is that? I have to explain this, of course. Let me give you the simplest example where S is just one event. Here it is, P, that's our event. And then let's look at what I plus of P is. I plus of P is the inside of the future light cone of that event. And notice that here I drew a little circle. That's to indicate that what we want to do is take a point out of the manifold here. Let's assume we've taken a point out of the manifold. It's not that we label that point a singularity. No, we simply say the manifold has a hole there. It's just like you take those hole punches and take a piece of paper, you make a hole there. It's just no paper there, right? So this is not a statement about the curvature going to infinity or anything. That would be a statement about the neighborhood of the point. But the singularity itself is the absence of something. It's the absence of something. There is literally a point missing on the manifold here. So we just punched a hole. As we will later see, we may be forced to punch holes. Or nature simply punches holes, at least according to classical general relativity. For example, because the curvature would go to infinity. You don't have a differentiable manifold with a differentiable Riemannian manifold or Lorentzian manifold with a curvature, let's say the curvature scalar going to infinity. But it's not only when the curvature scalar goes to infinity, other things can also go to infinity. And then we are forced to actually punch a hole into the manifold. So there's actually a point missing in it. So that's the situation here. We have a manifold, but there's a point missing. And as it happens, it's on the light cone of our event P. So that doesn't change I plus of P. I plus of P is the inside of this light cone. And then we can ask, OK, what is I plus of P? I mean, S is P in this case, bar. What's the closure of that? Well, the closure of that includes all those points on this branch of the forward light cone, all those points on that branch of the forward light cone, and all those points on that part of the forward light cone, because it's literally just, it's the closure. So you just take all those limit points there. This is not part of it, because it's not even a point of the manifold, right? OK, so that's I plus of S bar. What is J plus of S, though? What does it include? Does anyone want to hazard a guess? Yes?
It won't include the part above the...
That's right. That's right. J plus is the causal future, right? And the causal future contains all those events that can be reached from S, in this case from P, either traveling with matter or using light. And with matter, we get anywhere in here. With light, we get anywhere there. But with light, we cannot go there. So there's a difference between those two sets. Now, let us use the extendability or non-extendability of such curves, especially geodesics, such as null geodesics here. But they don't have to be null geodesics, as an indicator for the absence or the existence of a singularity. Remember that we don't have the luxury of knowing what the spacetime actually is. That's why we work with these very generic definitions there. We want eventually to arrive at singularity theorems that work with very general conditions and then draw a conclusion of the kind of, yep, there's got to be a singularity. Either a cosmological one or a black hole one. So a definition that we therefore employ is this. We pick a point of the manifold, and it's important that it is of the manifold. So it could be like here, any point, but of course not the one where there's a singularity, right? So we pick a point in the manifold, and then we say that it is the future or past endpoint of a curve gamma. So technically, we pick two things. We pick a point in the manifold, and we pick a curve gamma. And we say that the curve gamma has a future or past endpoint, which is P, if this condition holds true. Namely, the condition that for all neighborhoods, U of the point P there exists a parameter time. Every curve has a parameter, which we may call time, for example, even if it's not the time. So it has a parameter, let's say parameter value T naught, from which onwards the path, the curve, will stay within that neighborhood for all further parameter values. So we call P then an endpoint, because we can choose the capital U to be arbitrarily small. And we can choose it arbitrarily small, and there will always exist some parameter value T naught from which onwards the curve will stay within that neighborhood. doesn't mean that the curve actually hits the point P and then stops. It could also just asymptotically approach the point P. And for a past endpoint, of course, we can just reverse reverse this. We would say for all parameter times earlier than T naught, it's close. It's arbitrary. The further past of that curve is always within that neighborhood. Now, now P is an element of the manifold. And remember that the manifold is made out of points, each of which has epsilon neighborhoods around it. Right? That was like lecture one, where we considered these open neighborhoods around points of a manifold. Which means that it's always possible to extend a curve gamma continuously beyond P, because P is a point in the manifold. Which means that the existence of an endpoint, according to this definition here, doesn't indicate that there is a singularity at P. In fact, it cannot. P is a point of the manifold, after all. So it doesn't indicate that there is a singularity. But it simply indicates that we chose to end the curve there. We just parameterized it in such a way that we didn't want to go any further. But we could go further. So when we have such an endpoint, then it means we can extend it. Because P is a point in the manifold, it always has at least some epsilon neighborhood around it. But of course, what we are after is this kind of thing here, this kind of animal, where we have a hole in the manifold. So therefore, we say that a curve gamma is future inextendable, or analogously, past inextendable, if it does not possess a future endpoint. Right? Because if it does possess a future endpoint, we know, OK, P is a point of the manifold. It has the epsilon neighborhood. We could extend that curve. So what we're interested in is actually the situation where we don't have an endpoint. So we say that the curve is future inextendable if it does not possess a future past endpoint. Now, that doesn't mean that we have nailed down how to identify the presence of a singularity just yet, because the absence of an endpoint doesn't guarantee that there is a hole in the manifold. So the inextendability, the fact that we cannot further extend our trajectory, doesn't mean that we have already run up against one of those holes. No. There are two other possibilities, and here's the intuition for that. If gamma is future inextendable, then gamma either runs to infinity. How would you extend that further, right? It either runs to infinity, or it runs around in circles forever. Well, or it hits a hole, which is, of course, the case that we would like to find out about. Here's a theorem. Let's assume that C is some subset of our space-time, which is closed. And let's assume that Q is an element of the boundary of the chronological future of that set C. Okay, so the chronological future of a set C, C could be a point. Let's say chronological future of a set C, that would be like the inner part of a light cone. Actually, it's this picture, if you remember, like this one, right? So it's I plus of S. So it's all the inner parts of that. And let's assume that Q is an element of the boundary of that. So like here, or there, or there. But let's assume that Q is not itself inside of C. So let's assume that this point Q is not P itself. Or up in this picture, we are assuming that Q is not part of the S itself. We're assuming that it's sitting somewhere there. Or in this case here, right, this is what we're interested in here. What if Q is on the boundary of I plus P? So Q is on the boundary of I plus of C. Either here or there or there. Can't be this because that's technically not a point. We took it out, we punched a hole in there. Then the theorem says that Q lies on a null geodesic gamma inside of that boundary. And this null geodesic has two possibilities. It either has a past endpoint on C, or it is past inextendable because it meets a hole. Right? That's exactly the two situations where what we are saying here, let me just illustrate it on this picture. What this theorem says is what is intuitively obvious, namely that if Q is a point on the boundary of I plus P, then it has to be here, there, or on this piece, in which case there are two possibilities. It's either having has to be on a null geodesic, namely either this null geodesic, that null geodesic, or this null geodesic. And these null geodesics fall into two classes. One is that it could be a null geodesic that has a past endpoint on C, namely this null geodesic has a past endpoint on C, namely P. Right? We can write down a null geodesic that goes all the way there and then stops there. No matter what the parameter value does, it just stops there, and that makes P an endpoint of it. Or Q could also sit somewhere here, in which case it has a null geodesic that has a past endpoint here on P, or more generally on C. Or alternatively, this null geodesic that our point Q is sitting on could be this null geodesic, in which case it is past inextendable because there we cannot extend it there further. Right? That's a null geodesic that cannot be extended. In this case, because it meets the hole. We cannot say that this point is a past endpoint of that trajectory because it's not an element of the manifold. Okay, so in this way, we are nailing down more closely how we might identify what a singularity is. So what will be the strategy then? The strategy is to study inextendable curves. And this includes, as we said, these three cases. And I'm very sorry, I just realized that I relabeled them in a weird way because you see here, gamma runs to infinity. That's this one. That's B here. Right? It's the same ABC. I just explain a bit more what they are. So there's one case where gamma hits a singularity. That's where we saw that it's past inextendable. And that's, of course, the case that we'll be interested in for cosmology, past inextendability, right? Where we have geodesics that are past inextendable for cosmology. So you take the geodesic of a galaxy or something, and you follow it back into the past, back to the past, back to the past. We want to prove that eventually it becomes inextendable there. Of course, it's then not just one hole. It's a whole surface of singularity where all the geodesics end. All the geodesics end there. It could be a point, but it could also be a whole surface. But of course, in the case of a black hole, we might be interested in future inextendable curves, which is where if you just travel carelessly too close to a black hole, you end up being crushed in the singularity, and that's a future inextendable curve. Right, but you know, inextendable curves, as we said, could indicate a singularity, but they could also indicate that it's just running off to infinity or that stuff is going around and around in circles forever. And we will have to exclude those two cases so that we can pin down the existence of singularities. For the case of going around and around forever, we will also have to consider that case very carefully, because we must address the possibility that our space-time has causality problems that we haven't addressed yet. It's a bit weird. It takes a little while to wrap your mind around it, but let me explain. There could be an example of a space-time where you're going around and around, so you have, let's say, a time-like curve in the manifold, and here's a trajectory in the manifold, and I drew the forward light cone. Okay? And what you do is you travel back to the past, right? So this is a closed time-like loop. Now you might wonder, didn't we exclude this at the beginning of the lecture? No, we excluded something else. This is another weird thing that can happen. See, what we excluded at the beginning of the lecture is the possibility that our space-time doesn't even have past and future, in the sense that, you know, there could be space-times where you cannot specify the past and the future in a unique way such that the definition is continuous from one point to the other, right? Because you could go back and then suddenly what you thought was future pointing is past pointing. Manifolds like that can exist. It's a bit like, it's not mathematically the same as a Möbius strip, but you know, for a Möbius strip, you can't have a one side and another side. It has only one side, right? And so similarly there, you can't say this is the future or this is the past, at least not in a continuous fashion. This is a difficulty on top of it, which is that even if the space-time has everywhere a well-defined definition of this is the future, that is the past, there could still be the possibility of something like a wormhole where you can travel into something that looks like a black hole, you come out of something that looks like a white hole, and you're back in the past. Even though everywhere in the manifold there's a well-defined notion of what's the future, what's the past, you can still have closed time-like loops, perhaps. So what we will be concerned with is also the possibility of closed time-like curves and the conditions that lead to the absence of them. See, all of this is important because if, for example, we want to prove that in our past there was a singularity, a cosmological singularity, and we only look for inextendable curves, well, you know, we might just run into something weird like this. Who knows? You know, as I explained last time with the ice skater, right? When she pulls her hands in and spins faster and faster, all sorts of things might happen, right? If this is matter, you know, pieces might fly off. Hopefully not of this poor ice skater, but, you know, when the whole universe contracts, then who knows what might happen? I mean, just think of the future of the universe. If it was to recollapse, if it has any net angular momentum, you could expect it to rotate whatever is left, you know, very, very severely as it contracts. Similarly with black holes, you know, if you have spinning matter, it's not clear that the angular momentum barrier would be overcome it could be that it just spins so fast that a black hole never forms. So we have to be careful, because in these extreme circumstances, maybe such stuff could happen. So we have to be very clear about what space-times we allow and under which conditions this thing can happen. So we will have still a bit of material there, not today though, looking into this question: how do we avoid, how do we properly define the existence of such things, and how do we rule it out, and how do we rule it out in a stable way? You know, you could imagine that you that you don't have closed time-like curves, so the space-time looks like it's fine, but maybe if the space-time was just a little bit perturbed, you just put an apple more in there, so you have more gravity, that could tilt your forward light cones just enough so that suddenly you have a closed time-like curve where you didn't have it before. So what we want is exclude this, but not only exclude it, but also exclude it in a stable way. Okay, so this is all coming up. Today's lecture is a little shorter. I thought we might want to talk about essays. So we have like 15 minutes to talk about essay topics, what's expected, and sources, that sort of thing, whatever questions you might have.